Today on the Monocle Arts Review, we'll be wrapping things up at the Cannes Film Festival after a controversial competition last weekend. We'll be stepping out with Kate Beckinsale in a new Jane Austen film adaptation, Love and Friendship, and we'll also get lost down the rabbit hole in Alice Through the Looking Glass, the latest in Tim Burton's Mad as a Hatter series. And talking us through all of those films is the film critic for The Telegraph, Tim Robey. All that coming up on the Monocle Arts Review with me, Steve Bloomfield. Stay tuned. Tim, welcome to the Arts Review. You're freshly back on English soil after a couple of weeks in the French Riviera. We're going to talk about the Cannes Film Festival. Before we talk about the results, how was it as an experience? What was it? What was the vibe like, if I can put it that way, this year?
It was actually really quite positive. I think critics who I spoke to were just kind of surprised and impressed by how good a lot of the films were, particularly around the first weekend. We were seeing so many good films, and it slightly tailed off towards the end, and they sometimes deliberately do it that way so that they kind of save the bad stuff till the end.
But they want everyone to get excited about Cannes, and when you know people like yourself are still able to get stories about Cannes on the towards the front of the newspaper.
Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah, it's a good idea to front load it into the first weekend, and all the good stuff was there. For instance, the real stinker of the year was the Sean Penn film in competition, The Last Phase, which they stuck on at the very final Friday, so it was almost an afterthought. And people just sensed that it was bad. As soon as they saw it programmed in that slot, they
thought, you just tell? If it's put there, it can't be great.
Kind of, yeah. And it did look like Bono had directed a film. It's about how hard white people are trying in West Africa, and Charlize Theron and Javier Bardem just don't stand a chance at being any good in it. So.
And yet, I mean, you know, we'll go on to some other films in a moment, and yet the fact that it has those two famous actors in it has made it far easier for that film to get a bit of publicity compared to, say, you know, Beasts of No Nation.
That is true, and yet I think even Sean Penn himself said if this film gets a bad reception in Cannes, it's not going to get shown around the world, because it is more or less sink or swim, and it has definitely sunk. It's got some of the worst reviews I've ever seen for film in Cannes. deservedly so, to be honest.
Let's talk about the competition, because of course Cannes is a competition as well as a sort of a trade event as well. What out of those films that won prizes, which ones particularly stood out for you?
Well, it was a very weird set of awards. Everyone was so kind of happy about the general quality of the competition, and various favourites emerged in the first weekend, like the German film, Tony Erdmann, Jim Jarmusch's film, Patterson, and the Brazilian film called Aquarius. All three of those were very highly regarded, came away completely empty-handed. They didn't win a single prize. I think Tony Erdmann won the Fipresky Award, but that's given out separately. And instead, George Miller's jury went for some very strange options. I mean, Ken Loach won the Palme d'Or for the second time for his most popular film in a long while, to be fair. But then lower down, there was like Xavier Dolan's film, It's Only the End of the World, was booed at the press screening. Critics hated it. I mean, I actually would defend it up to a point, but I still think it's crazy that it came away with essentially the silver prize.
It was
silver
booed
prize.
At the screening.
Oh, yeah. A lot of stuff gets booed, though. I mean, you sort of have to take that as read. I mean, anything with a measure of controversy to it, or which is trying to be provocative, gets booed. Nicholas Winding Refn's film, The Neon Demon, was booed as well. But then the acting awards were rather odd. You know, there were so many great female performances to choose from this year. There was Sandra Hüller, the leading lady in the German film. There was Sonia Braga is fantastic in Aquarius, and yet they gave it to the actress in the Filipino film Ma Rosa, which, you know, it's a solid performance, but it just wasn't really outstanding. And the acting award, the best actor award, went to the Iranian film by Asghar Farhadi, The Salesman. Good performance. Also won best screenplay. Seems a bit much to give that film. It's him. It's Asghar Farhadi's kind of doing his thing again. So yeah, they missed chances, I think, to really. I mean, obviously, there's always the question that, you know, the jury is not full of film critics, and we're not necessarily going to have the same opinion about everything. But I do feel as though they did miss opportunities to reward some extremely good cinema and kind of went for some safe options, really.
And how important are the actual awards in the sense of, you know, obviously if you do well at Cannes, then that helps you, you know, get openings elsewhere to actually get your film seen around the world.
I mean, it does and it doesn't. Someone pointed out that, you know, last year's winner, Dupin, the Jacques Audiard film, had made something like $87,000 at the box office in America, even after winning the Palme d'Or. So that film was facing an uphill struggle anyway in terms of its release. And the Palme d'Or doesn't seem to have helped it very much at all. So commercially, it doesn't necessarily make that much difference. It's a more of a prestige thing, I think, and it's about filmmakers feeling as though Cannes is the right place to premiere their work and the wanting to come back again and again. I mean, obviously, Ken Loach has had so many films there now. This is his second Palme. And some of the other filmmakers in competition will be back again and again. Once you're in the fold, you're kind of in the fold. And it's a way to kind of keep filmmakers wanting to come, I think.
Okay, let's move on now to what's in the cinema this week. First up, Love and Friendship, which is Whit Stillman's take on the Jane Austen novella Lady Susan. Tim, we see remakes of Austen books all the time, Pride and Prejudice, Sense and Sensibility, but this one has been overlooked in the past. Why do you think that's the case?
I mean, I wasn't familiar with the novella, really. It's a very early bit of work by Austen, which she didn't publish until late in her career, and it's not often quite considered as part of the canon, if you like. It's not one of the six novels. So I think it's quite ingenious that Whit Stillman has picked that one, because it's, we don't know the story, and it's quite sort of risque and racy. It's about an adulteress, and she's manipulating everyone, kind of spinning them around her little finger.
Okay, well, why don't we hear a little bit of Kate Beckinsale as Lady Susan right now.
Sir James Martin. Vastly rich, rather simple.
How jolly. Tiny green balls. What are they called?
Peas.
If my daughter were not the greatest simpleton on earth, she'd be engaged to him now.
But, Mama, I can see Sir James is a kind man, but marriage is for one's whole life.
Not in my experience.
May I present Lady Susan?
Delighted to make your acquaintance.
He's handsome, isn't he?
In a calf-like way.
Mannerings in town.
Have you seen my husband?
Horrid woman. Deranged. But if she were going to be jealous, she should not have married such a charming man.
Does this woman always get her way?
She has an uncanny understanding of men's natures.
Now, I've seen the trailer, except I haven't seen the film yet, and you shouldn't judge a film by its trailer, but I'm not convinced.
Other people have said this to me, that the trailer is not selling them on it at all. I think maybe the rhythm of it doesn't work so well in the trailer. I really think this film is excellent. It's Whit Stillman's best film for a long time, yeah. Part of it is the reinvention of Kate Beckinsale. She hasn't done anything good, really, let's face it, for about 20 years.
Since Shooting Fish.
I mean, more or less. Or I mean, she can go back to when she did Jane Austen films in the 90s. She was in Emma on ITV and stuff. And she fits very well into that kind of mode. But also, ever since she's gone to Hollywood, she's just done, you know, the Underworld films and Van Helsing, all that kind of stuff. I think Whit Stillman has kind of rediscovered her intelligence, really. And she kind of coasts through the film just being brilliantly blithe and completely not caring what anyone thinks of her. It's quite a kind of self-aware performance, I think. I think she's really funny in it. And I think a lot of the supporting cast come up with the goods as well. He's been very clever at kind of looking at the book, and it's written as an epistolary novel. It's a little bit like Dangerous Liaisons. It's kind of letters back and forth revealing the schemes going on. And he's cleverly kind of inserted scenes in between the letters, if you like, to kind of fill in the plot blanks. I think it really rattles along, actually. And as you say, you know, I'm not sure it's the film that's ideally kind of cut out to be a good trailer. It doesn't work really in trailer form, because a lot of those punchlines are kind of like built into the rhythm of a whole scene, and they have there's a lot of other little jokes going on. I think Tom Bennett, who plays the kind of idiot character we heard talking about peas, just absolutely steals the film. I mean, it's gonna make him a star off the back of it, I think, as surely as someone like Tom Hollander was kind of propelled by Pride and Prejudice into people thinking, oh, he's got a real comic talent. So I'm really happy with it. I think it's Whit Stillman kind of coming good again, reminding us about his kind of like comedies of manners that he's always done really well, kind of transposing his quite bitey kind of satire from, you know, the Manhattan era of Metropolitan, his early films, to Austen society. But it works really well. And there's some good little digs at America in it as well. He's just kind of thought his way through it and has approached it with a really sort of satirical kind of sense of wit, I think.
Okay. You've talked me round. Love and Friendship premiered at Sundance, and it's out in the US, UK and Netherlands. But let's face it, I'm sure you can find it wherever you live. Finally, Tim Burton's Wonderland team are reunited in Alice Through the Looking Glass, a sequel to 2010's Alice in Wonderland. Here, Alice heads back to Wonderland in order to escape a difficult choice in real life and is reunited with Hatter, who is madder than ever. Let's hear a little clip now.
What's the matter?
The Hatter's the matter.
Hatter is my truest friend. If he's in need, I will help him. It will be a race against time. He is not someone you want as your enemy. Time is a he.
Underland. Your time is up.
We stuck us all at 1 minute to tea time.
Tea time forever!
There we are. Now, Tim, Alice in Wonderland did extremely well at the box office, over $1 billion. Do we think this one is going to do quite so well?
I doubt it, but also I hated Alice in Wonderland. I don't know about you, I absolutely hated it. And it wasn't just the kind of, you know, Lewis Carroll spinning in his grave at the kind of Disneyfication of it, if you like. But it was also how it looked. I think back in 2010, they did this conversion to 3D in post-production, when they really weren't ready to do that very well. So it was just such a murky and horrible experience. I felt as I was wading through this kind of gross undergrowth all the way through the film, just kind of thinking, waiting for something to look at that I wanted to be looking at. And I think six years on, technically they're in much better shape to actually do what they're trying to do here and kind of give you the kind of phantasmagoria, if you like. And I'm not going to make great claims for this film, but I was sort of dreading it after the first one, and it's significantly better.
You were dreading it, it's not that bad.
It's not too bad. I mean, as far as I'll go, they've made it very conventional, and they've thrown away the kind of the plot of the Lewis Carroll's book entirely. I mean, it's really only shares a title with it.
Which perhaps isn't necessarily a bad thing, because that's a really weird, slightly disturbed novel.
Such a weird book, and I don't know how you would adapt it in any straight way. What they've done instead is they've kind of turned it into this time travel story, which reminded me quite a lot of the third Harry Potter book, Azkaban. You could kind of go back and fix things in the past, so that Mad Hatter's family have been killed by the Jabberwocky, and Alice has to kind of jump in a gyrosphere and go back and kind of fix various mishaps that led to that happening, which is sort of, it just about strings itself along on that. But I mean, actually, it comes up with some good sequences. There's stuff with Sacha Baron Cohen, who plays Time, and he plays him with a kind of Werner Herzog accent, and like is just having no fun at all. He's having fun playing a character whose job is just like to be glumly in charge of killing everyone and kind of like charging through the day. Sacha Baron Cohen actually does that rather well. It's directed by the guy who started out on the Ali G show, James Bobbin, and he then went to do the Muppets films.
Yeah.
And he's definitely, there's something with him and Sacha Baron Cohen, they kind of vibe together quite well.
So Tim Burton's taken a step back.
Tim Burton's not directing this
one. And is that actually a good thing in a way?
Probably, I think. I mean, the extent to which he really directed the first one is debatable anyway, because it was such a kind of effects kind of extravaganza. I always wonder really how much control the director has over that kind of exercise, and whether it's more of a studio kind of edict to kind of like structure the whole thing. I mean, There are Burtonish touches in here as well. There are also touches of, I don't know if you remember, Return to Oz, the Wizard of Oz sequel from the 80s, which is a very weird, scary film. But the director clearly likes that film, because there's a scene in an asylum with Alice waking up and being kind of told that she's mad. And there's some kind of quite novel stuff in it. And I like the idea of time as a kind of clockwork engine for the universe. And when things go wrong, it starts rusting over, and there's this great effects showdown at the end where the whole of the universe is kind of rusting. And I think they pull that off well. It's absolutely fine.
It's absolutely fine. I notice we haven't mentioned Johnny Depp yet.
Yeah,
does he essentially do his I'm a bit mad as Johnny Depp type thing?
He's just as bad as he was in the first one. I'm kind of trying to ignore the fact that he's in it. The problem is that they depend for the emotional core of the film on him, because it's all about making the Mad Hatter happy again. And you really couldn't care less. I mean, the characterization is so irritating. Everyone else, I think, is doing better. You know, Helena Bonham Carter's having fun, even though she's basically doing Queenie from Blackadder. Sacha Baron Cohen is really quite fun. And Mia Wasikowska better in this than she was in the first one, which I thought she seemed completely lost.
Okay, there we are. The absolute perfectly fine, Alice Through the Looking Glass. It's out now. You'll be able to see it. You won't be able to ignore it. That's it for today's show. Thank you very much to my guest, Tim Rober. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Steve Bloomfield. The show was produced by Holly Fisher and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us again at the same time on Monday. We'll be looking at the week ahead in art. But for now, goodbye from me, and thanks very much for listening.